This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The WNBA Finals began Wednesday night at the Mohegan Sun Arena in Uncasville, Connecticut, home of the Eastern Conference champion Sun. Expanded to a best-3-of-5 game format, the series found the West's best team, the Sacramento Monarchs, facing what should have been a disadvantage, since the Monarchs wouldn't play at home until Game 3. In the Sacramento locker room an hour before the tip-off, Monarchs forward DeMaya Walker was listening to gospel music on her headphones. When the song was over, she wouldn't acknowledge any significant disadvantage to opening the season on the road.
If we had our choice, we'd rather have home court advantage, so I can't say that it's not. But the way we look at it is our record, you know, is great at home, but it's rather good on the road, too. So it's probably an advantage. Unless you're playing us, then it's just a regular game.
Among the 8,200 fans on hand for Wednesday night's game, the question was whether Lindsey Whalen, the Suns' point guard and perhaps their most essential player, would dress for the game, let alone start. Whalen had broken a bone in her knee in a collision during a semifinal game 4 days earlier. In the Suns' locker room before the tip-off, Connecticut forward Brooke Wyckoff maintained that inspiration was the right word for Whalen's contribution to the team.
I think she's definitely the type of player that can fall into that role. She's a trooper, and that's all you can say about her. I mean, she did it in the final game in the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, she had injured herself in the first half and came out. Nobody really knew how badly injured she was, but she played great. And I know our team is pumped up, you know, to have her, obviously, and I know the crowd will be too.
When Connecticut's starting lineup was announced, it became apparent that Brooke Wyckoff was right. It would have been a fine story if Whalen, who wore a bulky knee brace on Wednesday night, could have coaxed the Sun to victory that evening, and for a time it looked as if it might happen that way. Connecticut broke on top and led for most of the game, though never by much. But in the second half, the visiting Monarchs became encouraged by a series of events. One of their number essentially tackled 7-foot-2-inch Sun center Margot Dedeck around the neck and was not called for a flagrant foul. Monarch sharpshooter Yolanda Griffith, on her way to a game-high 25 points, began to understand that she couldn't miss that night. And at the other end of the court, various members of the Sun began finding Monarchs or fans with the passes that had previously found teammates. The home team fell behind. In the closing seconds of the game, Whalen herself missed a shot that might have reversed the momentum, but she wasn't alone. The final score was 69-65, Sacramento. In the press conference that followed the game, Sacramento coach John Wisnett complimented the opposition.
They're a great shooting team. I think if we played the games of horse, they would win the game for sure. But I still think Connecticut is probably the best offensive team in the WNBA.
When his turn at the podium came, Connecticut coach Mike Tebow urged members of the media not to complicate the obvious.
Basketball becomes very black and white to me a lot of times. There's not a lot of gray area in some areas, and turnovers was very specific to me. The game was lost by turning the ball over.
It's a convincing argument. The Sun turned the ball over 15 times to 7 for the opposition, an uncharacteristically sloppy performance. But I couldn't help asking Coach Tebow if the mugging of Margot Dedeck hadn't been a turning point in this game.
Well, I thought we got screwed on that play, to put it bluntly. But, you know, I don't know that that was the turning point. I think the turning point was trying to force 3 passes in 5 possessions into the teeth of the defense. You know, one goes sailing out of bounds, one gets tipped, another one they pick up off the floor and go. Those turn into easy baskets for them. And that's hard to recover from in a 2 or 4 point game.
As soon as game one was over, recovery became a critical concern for the Sun, who'd seen their home court advantage evaporate. It was easy to suppose that the post-game mood in the Connecticut locker room would be grim, but Sun forward Brooke Wyckoff was smiling as if nothing had happened, or rather, as if her team had won. I wondered how she managed that.
It's just a game. I mean, this is just, despite, you know, losing and all that kind of stuff, I mean, this is basketball. And, you know, you got to have fun regardless of the outcome. You're going to win some, you're going to lose some. And I know that's a cliche, but it's really true, so.
Maybe Brooke Wyckoff was smiling because she'd had a premonition. The following night, with 8 seconds to go in Game 2, Wyckoff calmly drained a three-pointer from the corner to force overtime. The Sun outscored the Monarchs 7-0 over the next few minutes, evening the finals at one game apiece. The two teams will play Games 3 and 4 in Sacramento tomorrow and Tuesday. Game 5, if necessary, will be back in Connecticut on Thursday. If you're a baseball fan in Colorado, Pittsburgh, Kansas City, or Tampa, you've probably lost hope. But otherwise, your team may well still be in contention for a place in the postseason. Joining me now to discuss how the wild cards will fall is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Until recently, the American League Central Division was all but conceded to the Chicago White Sox. Now the Sox are struggling. Their once insurmountable lead looks decidedly surmountable. What happened?
Well, they stopped hitting, Bill, basically. This team has won the majority of the season with a great starting rotation, a very underrated bullpen, and just a decent offense. But the decent offense wasn't even decent here recently. The starting pitching hasn't been as great as it's always been. Now, the White Sox are going to hang on, and they're going to win this division. I don't think they're that worried about that. I think they should be more worried about who are they going to beat in the playoffs, because it has been a couple of months since they were a really good team, and it's just because a bunch of the guys on that team just haven't played the way they did the first 3 months. But they do have time to put it back together, but they're a bad short, Bill, at least one bad short, and I wonder if they're going to hit enough in the postseason.
Well, with that prediction, you have slammed the door on the Cleveland Indians. You don't think they can win that division?
I don't, but I think they can win the wild card, although I don't think they're going to win the wild card either. And trust me, Bill, when I tell you this, A, don't believe me, because we've been over how many times I've been wrong over the years, but I love the Indians. I love the way they play. I love the way they never veered from the course. That is, they didn't go out and sign some guys to make $8 million a year or just average players. They rebuilt, and they did it right, and they were supposed to be good this year. I didn't think they were going to make it this quickly. I just think there was too much of a gap between them and the White Sox in order to pass them. And keep in mind, Chicago's beaten Cleveland 10 times in 13 games this year, and even though they play six more times, I don't think Cleveland's going to beat them enough to pass them.
Let's talk about another American League team with a shot at the wild card, the can't-pitch-much, can't-field-much New York Yankees. Is it surprising to see this team in the position that it's in at this point of the season, despite all the thoroughly documented problems?
Well, I'm amazed in a way, but the one thing I have done right this year, Bill, is I have never given up on the Yankees for obvious reasons. We talk about it all the time. Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera, just the whole Yankee mystique. I figured somehow, some way, they would get to the playoffs. They still might not, but I think they will. They can still win the division, which is astounding. The most astounding thing...
Wait, doesn't a buzzer go off at some point when he says that on this program?
Well, it should. But keep in mind, Bill, this team has been through everything this year. They have had, by all rights, a terrible season, and yet they're still right here. I mean, that tells you all you need to know about the Yankees and where they're going, is that they are still in this thing.
Tim, if the Yankees don't reach the postseason, either by overtaking the Red Sox or getting the wild card, what is the chance that George Steinbrenner does the heretofore unthinkable and fires Joe Torre?
You know, I just can't see it, Bill. I just can't see firing Joe Torre. I mean, George has to understand that this is as much his team as anybody's team. He's the guy who signed these guys. He's the guy who suggested, hey, let's go get Gary Sheffield. Hey, let's go get Kevin Brown. And you could make a case that Joe Torre has done a pretty good job with this team this year, given all the changes they've had to make, all the injuries they've had, and all the pressures they've been under. Given all that's gone wrong, I'm amazed the Yankees are still here.
There's the buzzer. It was just a little late. It'll teach you to say the Yankees might catch the Red Sox.
That's very funny, Bill.
The race for the AL West title between the Oakland A's and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim in Orange County, just north of Mexico, could go down to the final week. Which team prevails there?
Well, I still got the Angels winning, although they just lost 4 games in a row to Seattle and Detroit, and that's not a good sign. However, The point is that their schedule is slightly easier than the A's, but more important, the A's two best players are hurt. Bobby Crosby, their best all-round player, you know, he might not play till the final few days of the season, if then. And Rich Harden, who certain days this year has been the best pitcher in the entire American League, has been hurt also. It's amazing that the A's are where they are, given the terrible start that they got off to. First team in American League history to go from 15 games under 500 to 15 games over 500. They just will not go away. However, I think with the Angels' schedule and the injuries to the A's, I think the Angels are going to find a way to win that division.
Some team in the National League West will finish first, probably the San Diego Padres. But can we make a new rule that they have to stay home and get replaced by a team that has, well, I don't know, a record that's better than 500?
You know, that's been brought up many times by people who didn't laugh after they said it, Bill. They think there should be a rule now where the second best wild card team replaces the San Diego Padres. I'm not ready to do anything that drastic, although this is a very unusual year to have a team like this. No team's gone to the playoffs with a 500 record, let alone sub-500. 82 wins is the fewest by a team that's gone to the playoffs. There's a very good chance at this point the Padres are going to make it with just a 500 record. But, sorry, this only happens once every 20 years or so. It's kind of fun when it does happen, but if anybody really believes that the Padres are actually going to beat a couple teams and get to the World Series, well, with the team they have now, that's not going to happen.
The Astros, the Marlins, the Phillies, the Nationals, all in contention for a wild card spot, and the lights aren't all out in Milwaukee yet, although they might be very soon. Who stands out among those in your eyes?
Well, I picked the Marlins at the beginning of the year, and I'm going to stick with them for a couple of reasons. Their starting pitching is at least potentially as good as any team in the National League except for that of the Astros. Plus, their offense, at least in theory, is much better than Houston's, and I still think, despite their very, very difficult schedule the rest of the way, that the Marlins are going to find a way to win the wild card. But there's no guarantee there. This whole National League wild card race has me thoroughly perplexed, as do the races in the American League. I have never seen a season where we're going to enter the postseason with eight teams, and there isn't a clear favorite among the eight, and I have no idea who to pick among the eight.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. He is also our regular baseball analyst. Tim, thank you very much, and enjoy the home stretch.
Well, thank you very much, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce pays us a visit from the Tar Heel State. But first,
me llamo Alex Rodriguez. Que viva baseball.
Me llamo Manny San Guillén. Viva baseball. Arriba.
Me llamo Orlando Cepeda. Viva baseball.
Latino influence in modern baseball is undeniable. Currently, 44% of all professional baseball players in the United States are from Spanish-speaking countries. But contemporary fans of the international pastime might be surprised to learn that there's been a strong Latin American influence in Major League Baseball for over nine decades. Viva Baseball is a new film celebrating that influence. It premieres this Friday on Spike TV. Joining me now from NPR's New York Bureau to discuss Viva Baseball is producer-director Dan Cloris. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. A pleasure being here.
Cuban pitcher Adolfo Luque became the first Latino star when he joined the Boston Braves in 1914. Was he celebrated only because he was a fine pitcher?
Well, Luque was an excellent pitcher who pitched for the Braves, for the Cincinnati Reds, for the Giants, for the Dodgers. They called him Dolph Luque. He was celebrated. He was notorious, as well as a guy who had notoriety. He did have a temper. He was an educated baseball guy, later went on to be a prominent manager in Cuba. But Luque would be goaded into explosive behavior. Mm-hmm. He was the first white Cuban star in the big leagues. The first Cubans came to the big leagues as early as 1903, believe it or not. But whites were allowed to play. Dark-skinned Cubans could not.
In breaking baseball's color line in 1947, Jackie Robinson opened the major leagues to many more players from Latin American countries than had previously been allowed to play. Do Latinos recognize that part of Robinson's legacy?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. To black Latin, Indians who had to endure a triple form of discrimination, skin color, language, and customs. The Robinson breaking the barrier was just a sign of hope. It meant so much to them. As they say in Viva Baseball, Vic Power says it. He says, "When Jackie made it, I thought maybe this can happen to me too."
The Mexican League raided the U.S. major leagues following World War II player shortages. League director Jorge Pascal netted 23 major leaguers, including Sal Magley and Monty Irvin, among others. Here's Dodgers owner Branch Rickey talking about that circumstance.
"I'm glad that Mr. Pascal likes baseball. I hope it becomes a great national game in Mexico. It is too bad that he did not approach baseball in the United States through the front door."
What did Branch Rickey mean by using the term front door?
Well, I mean, this was such a threat to the baseball establishment. I mean, I guess that Rickey meant, well, come to us first and discuss this, so then we could turn you down, you know? But the interesting thing was the commissioner, Happy Chandler, who punished big leaguers for going to Mexico with the threat of a lifetime ban. In those days, 1947, he not only had the power to punish American big leaguers, but Cuban players who went to Mexico. Cuban players playing in Cuba who went to Mexico would also be banned from playing in Cuba. So, because the American baseball establishment had a contract with the Cuban baseball establishment at the time. So it was very, very threatening. And although it meant a lot of more money to players, like, as you say, Max Lanier went there, Monty Irvin, Buck Leonard, Sal Magley, but they suffered greatly. Danny Gardella in the film, who was an outfielder, was banned for 5 years.
I think one of the things most striking in your film is Victor Poyet, a.k.a. Vic Power, the ability that he has to bring a sense of humor to some of the degrading circumstances that he faces.
Vic Power was a wonderful player. When he finally got to the major leagues, he won 7 gold gloves with Cleveland and Kansas City and Minnesota as a first baseman. He's generally regarded as, if not the greatest fielding first baseman of all time, certainly as one of them. In the minor leagues in the early 50s, in the Yankees farm system, Vic Power led all of the minor leagues in hitting. Yankees wouldn't call him up. Yankees wanted the first Negro to be compatible with their philosophy, which was a philosophy of just playing the game and not having the spotlight put on you. Power was considered a showboat. He drove a Cadillac convertible. Power fielded with one hand. And most of all, Vic Power was not only outspoken, but he committed the cardinal sin in the mid-1950s. He was a dark-skinned Puerto Rican, and he dated white women. The Yankees didn't like that. In the film, it's very clear. There was an absolute decision made that we need someone more compatible to us. Thus, Elston Howard, a great athlete and a wonderful baseball player who roomed with Power in the minor leagues, actually. Howard was called up, and Power was traded to then the Kansas City Athletics. And if you remember, they were the worst team in baseball, and every year the Yankees would fleece the Athletics and dump their players on them, and you know that's how they got Roger Maris and other players. And Power endured that, and you're right. He covers his pain throughout the film with his humor, and every once in a while it slips. And you see, he was called to the major leagues at 28, Orlando Cepeda, who grew up idolizing Vic Power in Puerto Rico, says, probably correctly, that if Power came up to the major leagues when he was supposed to at 20, he'd be in the Hall of Fame today, which is an issue that many of those players, Latin players, of their generation have. They should be in the Hall of Fame, but many of their great years were robbed from them.
Orestes Minoso was a major star for the Chicago White Sox in the 1950s. The nickname Mini Minoso was forced upon him. Pitcher Louis Tiant was dubbed El Tiante by Boston fans and the media, and the dignified Roberto Clemente was also given a nickname by play-by-play announcers.
Bob Clementi's hit drives in Skinner.
Bob Clementi dribbles a grounder.
Bob Clementi hits to right, lifts a towering fly to Bob Clementi, and the Pirates win 3-2.
When the announcers and the sports writers and the American public in general gave the nicknames Bob, Bobby, Minnie to these players, were those examples of racism, or were those times when they were just trying to become more comfortable with players from another culture?
It might have been racism on some degree. It was just a lack of education, exposure. And the Latin player was so filled with fear coming to this new country, dealing with everything around him and back home, that to speak up he thought was a fruitless thing to do. So let's just accept it. Was it virulent racism to change their names? Probably not. Was it guided by race? Yes. Clearly, was it offensive to the Latin player? To many of them, yes. Some accepted it and some did not. Minoso has a beautiful name. Orestes Saturino Minoso was baffled by it because Minnie is a girl's name. But with years of being called Minnie, 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 so he accepts it.
Toward the end of Viva Baseball, you celebrate several current Latino stars. Did you finish the film before the steroid scandal cast doubt on Sammy Sosa's integrity?
No. I battled with that issue in terms of what I would do with Sosa. I have Sosa at the end of the film, the celebration of him being this great home run hitter. The parade in New York City and his introduction by the First Lady and by the Vice President's wife in front of a joint House of Congress. The reason I decided to keep that in was because it was Felipe Alou whose voiceover says, we would never dream that a Dominican can hit 500 home runs, a Dominican can challenge the record of Babe Ruth. I felt Alou is giving me the Dominican perspective, and especially Alou, a man of great intelligence and depth. So for me to put my judgment, which is clearly that Sosa is a steroid user, right, and to take away from the pride and the feeling that Dominicans have towards Sosa, regardless of his steroid abuse, right, I felt that's not my decision. However, I did take out Rafael Palmeiro.
Dan Cloris produced and directed Viva Baseball, which premieres Friday on Spike TV, presumably between Dr. No and For Your Eyes Only. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. This week in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a bevy of Bunker Brigands in braces is trying to wrest the John Q. Hammonds Hotel Classic title from last year's winner, the venerable Grand Dame of the LPGA Tour, Annika Sorenstam. But the early success of Michelle Wee, Paula Creamer, and others has many on the tour wondering about the ability of teen linksters to balance the demands of pro golf with the rest of their lives. Greg Eklund reports.
Now on the tee from Boca Raton, Florida, Morgan Pressel.
Morgan Pressel's senior year of high school is well underway. She scored an outstanding 1350 on her SAT exam, but Pressel, whose classroom these days is out on the golf course, plans to bypass attending Duke after verbally committing and instead play professional golf. Earlier this month, Pressel took part in the Junior Solheim Cup match between the U.S. and Europe. Just before that, she made her last appearance of the year on a sponsor's exemption at an LPGA event, the State Farm Classic in Springfield, Illinois.
And join us right now is the amateur Morgan Pressel. And Morgan, great playing this week. A final round of 6 under 66, and every day you were 2 shots better.
Part of Pressel's education is dealing with the media, as in this recent interview on ESPN2. Pressel's desire to turn pro out of high school is not unprecedented, but some tour veterans, like State Farm Classic winner and San Jose State graduate Pat Hurst, believe young golfers miss something when they forego college.
I wish they would go, to college at least a couple of years just to get the experience, of being away from home and just to have fun. But, if this is what they want, then more power to them.
In limited appearances by teen sensations Morgan Pressel and Michelle Wee, they've proven they can compete with the veterans. In this year's U.S. Women's Open, Pressel tied for second, and Michelle Wee was in the top 25. 19-year-old Paula Creamer, a 2-time winner as a tour rookie, would be a candidate for LPGA Player of the Year. Christy Kerr, who also bypassed college, merits consideration as well. Kerr, who struggled early in her career out of high school, is amazed by what Creamer has accomplished this year.
She's doing things, honestly, you would never think a rookie could do, but we all heard about her before she came out on tour, and you just know when somebody's good. You can just tell.
Kerr turned professional in 1996, but competed for 6 years before earning her first tour win.
People don't realize how difficult it is to win. I'll tell you, well, first of all, it's hard to learn how to win. And for many years, Annika was a conditional player out here. So winning is a learned behavior, and you've got to learn how to do it well and learn how to win to be able to win again and again and again and again.
Creamer has shattered that theory this season. Teens from the U.S. and Asia are hanging in there on the leaderboard because they can drive the ball as far as tour veterans do. But the biggest difference is the extensive amateur schedule that prepares aspiring pros for competition. Pat Hurst was the Tour Rookie of the Year in 1995.
I think someone like Paula, she's a lot more mature than her age. And she's played in a lot of golf tournaments. This isn't something new to her. When I came out, I played basically one tournament in the summer. I'd play the U.S. Amateur, try to qualify for the U.S. Open. But they're more seasoned now, and I think they're just used to it.
The trend of teens turning pro concerns the LPGA's new commissioner, Carolyn Bivens. The LPGA is sponsoring a January conference to explore the subject. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Springfield, Illinois.
You're listening to Only a Game. Timothy Brenner, who listens to Only a Game online, emailed recently in response to Kim Green's story on the September 3rd edition of the program about religious services at auto racing events. The show about the racetrack ministry was crazy, he wrote, and it should have been approached as any sports superstition. What makes it a story is that if you don't play along, it could be career-ending. NPR's pandering to the religious right has gone too far when a sports show feels the need for religiously slanted stories. Mr. Brenner closes his email with, "I love Only a Game and wish KUAR in Little Rock would carry it." From your mouth to God's ear, Mr. Brenner. My story in last week's program about ascending 812-foot Jerimoth Hill to the highest point in Rhode Island provoked several Rhode Islanders to write, "You might want to call the Johnston Landfill and ask them how high the dump is," suggested Zane Clavery, who hears the program on WRNI. Simon Cundiff, another WRNI listener, emailed as follows, "I had to write in to correct your facts. The highest point in Rhode Island is actually the Newport Bridge. It stands at 1,600 feet. I guess I should have made it more clear that the High Pointers Club, the members of which climb to the highest points in various states, aren't interested in dumps, bridges, television antennas, or other man-made pinnacles." Carl Pales, a Barbersville, Virginia resident who hears the show on WMRY, wrote, "I used to like your show, but Charlie Pierce can apparently no longer provide his once entertaining commentary without taking weekly shots at the Bush administration, as he did again over the response to Hurricane Katrina. Thus, I'm looking elsewhere on the dial for Saturday morning entertainment. When I want political commentary, I listen to Daniel Shore or other NPR contributors. I don't need it on Only a Game." Scott Provost, a WBUR listener, wrote to say, "I enjoy your website, especially the book reviews section. I'm an avid sports fan and appreciate good writing." Ah, So he's the one. You can tell us what you think by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can write us at onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, 02215, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. If you're a lineman, whether for the county or anywhere else, have we got a competition for you. But first, joining me from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for a discussion of the week's news is Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
What's up in North Carolina? Did college basketball begin again while I wasn't looking?
Actually, no. There's a big college football game on Saturday between the University of North Carolina and the University of Wisconsin. Throw out the record books when those traditional rivals tee it up. But no, I'm down here doing radio duty elsewhere in the NPR empire.
There you go. The National Collegiate Athletic Association's contribution to the welfare of people uprooted by Hurricane Katrina is to prevent athletes who've transferred out of schools that are underwater from playing somewhere else. That edict was handed down this week. Why not suspend the transfers aren't eligible for a year rule under present circumstances?
Because it would be a decent and humane thing to do, and the NCAA gets hives when asked to do any of that kind of stuff. Basically, this is an organization that's rigid when it wants to be, flexible when it wants to be, and doesn't answer to anyone at any time ever because it doesn't want to.
The St. Louis Rams director of football operations, Samir Suleiman, left a voicemail with St. Louis sports columnist Bernie Miklisch threatening to slash his throat after Miklisch wrote about turmoil within the Rams organization. This week, Rams president John Shaw told the Post-Dispatch that Suleiman, quote, will be reprimanded and it will be handled internally. So, any chance heads will roll?
Sure doesn't sound like there's any turmoil in that front office to me, does it? I mean, no, this is disgraceful. This guy should be fired. This is the second time in a couple of years that Post-Dispatch writers have been threatened in this way by somebody in the St. Louis sports firmament. I don't know what's going on down there. But this is the kind of indecency that gets you fired at widget firms in, you know, Jefferson City. And it certainly ought to have the same result in places like in a major sports enterprise in St. Louis.
Charlie, are you ready for some baseball Monday night style?
Never, but go ahead anyway.
Well, ESPN and Major League Baseball have agreed to an 8-year deal worth $2.3 billion. I guess they're ready for some baseball.
Yeah, I think, this will go back. I guess, you know, the old mantle of the old game of the week will now be shared by the Fox game on Sunday and the ESPN game on Monday night.
I don't know how baseball is going to top what happened last Monday when a fight broke out between 9 Eagles and Falcons players. Maybe Major League Baseball can stage some old-fashioned rhubarbs every Monday.
This was a very big black eye for the National Football League and a very dumb thing for the Philadelphia Eagles to do. The Philadelphia Eagles lost Jeremiah Trotter, arguably their best defensive player, in return for a bunch of special team schlubs from the other side. It almost got the aging broadcast crew of Al Michaels and John Madden. It almost got their pulse up above that enjoyed by the various plants around the Only Game World Headquarters.
The National Hockey League triumphantly announced a 10-year radio deal this week, Charlie.
Listen to us, please.
So another step in pro hockey's climb out of its niche status.
Is there an Outdoor Life radio network? Is that what they're on, or are they on someplace else?
Oh, it's XM.
Oh, they're at satellite. It's Outdoor Life satellite radio. the sound of crickets and rubble and rippling water from satellites to the world over.
One of the latest of several hockey players to decide that the year's enforced recess had ended his career is one of the best to ever play the game, Mark Messier. He's 44. I don't think we have time to list all of his accomplishments, but what's the most remarkable among them as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think clearly the most remarkable among them was going to New York and almost immediately handing the Rangers their first Stanley Cup since 1940. He is the equivalent in that regard of what Curt Schilling did in Boston for the Red Sox last year. He was terrific. He played in the shadow of Wayne Gretzky with nary a complaint. He was a great player in obscurity, then he became a great player in the spotlight, and he's headed to the Hall of Fame, assuming people have found the keys to the Hall of Fame by now.
We've talked before about how Shaquille O'Neal wants to be a police officer, and he got some practice this week in Miami Beach to the dismay of one Michael Gonzalez.
He did. He hauled in some folks, Big Daddy, Big Sheriff, Big Matt Dillon guy. He's very serious about this. Now, I don't know how serious the Miami Heat are about having their one of their meal tickets going on things like drug raids and so forth. Because you know what, Bill? It doesn't matter. If you're 7'2 and the other guy is 4'11, if the other guy's gun is like 3 feet long.
It seems to me there's some possible confusion when we use the phrase Miami Heat. Do we mean the Miami Police Department or the basketball team?
I think the Miami Heat is bringing the Miami Heat.
That's exactly right.
On behalf of the Miami Heat.
If anyone has a better, more secure, more lucrative basketball job than Gino Auriemma, who coaches the women's team at the University of Connecticut, I don't know who it is. Why would he even consider becoming head coach of the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury?
Well, the quick answer is to drive Jim Calhoun crazy. I have a pro job, and I have a pro offer, and you don't, nah, 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 boo-boo, yelling down the hallways outside their offices. I think it's a serious attempt by the Mercury, but I don't think it's being taken too seriously. People do not easily give up empires, and that's pretty much what Gino has in stores.
According to British Prime Minister Tony Blair, the victory of England over Australia in the ongoing Ashes 2005 cricket tournament has, quote, given cricket a huge boost and lit up the whole summer. And I guess that's not just because the match took almost the whole summer to play, right?
It hasn't lit up the whole summer. It's been sort of a low hum, a lovely low hum over the countryside. Tony Blair is pretty anxious for anything he can latch onto these days. But I think the ongoing, as you pointed out, the reason it you can use the phrase the whole summer is that's how long it takes. But I'm sure that the cricketers are happy with it. But I have a real feeling that, you know, the average Man U fan site is not really interested in how long. Oh, are they still playing? Bloody hell.
Finally, Charlie, a recent change in Italian gaming rules has made it possible for people to bet legally on the Miss Italy beauty pageant. And that has upset many contestants and officials, including competition founder Enzo Mirigliani, who said that betting, quote, damages the girl's dignity, bringing them down to the level of champion racehorses. I always thought champion racehorses were treated pretty well.
And people bet on them.
This is
a very good thing. I don't think I want to attend like the yearling sale anytime soon.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and never spits the bit on Only a Game. I thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Today in Kansas City, over 200 teams from the United States, Ireland, Great Britain, Canada, and Jamaica will compete in the third and last day of the 2005 International Linemen's Rodeo. Last weekend, linemen from New England and New York State took part in an event which, though smaller in scale, was nonetheless big on skill, passion, and professional pride. Only a Game's Karen Given was there, and she has our report.
You boys ready to go?
Yeah!
Okay.
It begins predictably enough with the national anthem piped out of a portable CD player. But at the 7th Annual Northeast Public Power Line Workers Rodeo, the flags are raised by bucket truck to four guys hanging off the tops of power poles 30 feet in the air. Linemen have been competing in rodeos in places like Kansas City for more than 20 years. 7 years ago, Bob Risley, a lineman with Burlington Electric Company, came up with the idea of bringing a rodeo to this beach on Lake Champlain in Burlington, Vermont. Risley has run the event ever since.
You go down south and they love these kind of things. Up here in New England, we're a little different breed, so
we don't get the big draw that we would like. You know?
Well, you know, rodeos don't generally happen in Vermont.
No, and when you say the word rodeo, everybody figures you're going to come out here to horses and cows and bull riding and all of that stuff.
Instead of bull riding and barrel roping, these rodeo stars compete in the speed climb, hurt man rescue, and the esoterically named underground pothead and elbow termination. The horses and cows have been replaced by power poles and rescue dummies. Everyone here stresses that the rodeo is actually a safety competition. They stress safety so often that it begins to sound like they've promised these guys a day of fun and given them a mundane training session.
No, I haven't tricked them. It is fun. The teams that you see here love their work. They're here because that's what it is for them. It's getting up in the morning, going to work every day, and screaming up a pole like this individual is right here. He's having a ball. It's not a scary thing for him. It's not a nervous thing for him. It's a I can't wait to do it thing.
These days, line workers might have a while to wait between climbing poles. Since the 60s, utilities have moved to bucket trucks, and sometimes line workers will go weeks or even months without climbing a pole. Even at the line workers' rodeo, bucket trucks make an appearance, lifting 90-pound dummies 30 feet in the air to be rescued over and over again. With 23 years in the business and knees that show his age, Pete Crowley of Burlington Electric is out of breath and noticeably sore after his climb. But the pain hasn't dampened the joy of showing his stuff in front of family and friends.
Yeah, it's like going to, back in high school, remember we used to go to the football games, and you kind of were excited about, you know, all your friends, seeing the same thing, same kind of competition, so it is nice.
Start out your hand on the pole. When you're ready, it's ready, set, go.
Ronnie Medeiros, a lineman from Taunton, Massachusetts, talks the teams through the rules for the one true race of this rodeo, the speed climb. Even here, linemen have to show control as they race up a pole and then back down, trying hard not to pierce the raw egg they hold in their mouths. For the most part, the long list of regulations printed out on the judge's score sheet are things linemen are supposed to be watching out for every day.
But on this event here, because you have to put an egg in them out when they come down, right? If they break the egg, that's a 10-point deduction of crack. Hot dog is a 10-point deduction. And a cut out or fall to the ground. So if they fall off the pole, they get 10-point deduction. Plus, we call the ambulance, give them a ride.
Wes Reed of New Hampshire Electric Co-op pops a flawless egg out of his mouth at the end of his climb. With less than 5 years on the job, Reed is still considered a rookie. Like most of the younger competitors here, he'd like to prove his worth with a win.
We're going to try. We're going to try our hearts out. So.
What do you get if you win?
Glory. Glory. Bragging rights.
As the baby boomers begin to retire, the industry is working overtime to replace them with new recruits like Reed. At the lineman's relay, it becomes clear where years of experience can come in handy. The event starts simply enough, with a climber going up the pole to retrieve a theoretically burnout cutout, which is basically a large fuse.
Just go nice and easy. Nice and easy does it.
The fuse is repaired on the ground, but it has to be reinstalled using a telescoping switching stick. As the plastic pole is extended 30 feet in the air, it sways in the breeze, while the groundsman tries to balance the cutout in its cradle and flip it over to close the circuit.
Time.
Good job, guys.
Mike Hagopian's team has a good time going when his groundsman begins easing the cutout into place. Just when it looks like he's about to close the circuit, the cutout falls to the ground. He makes the same mistake a second and then a third time. The small crowd starts wandering away, and even the judges, who had been offering encouragement, become quiet. Just as his teammate is about to try to close the circuit on his fourth attempt, Hagopian yells out, "There's a lady down the street on oxygen. She needs her power." It seems like a cruel time for a joke, but the cutout finally snaps into place. As Hagopian explains later, he wasn't trying to be mean.
Well, you see, a lot of times when we have to put people out of power or they're out of power because of a storm, those are the ones we go and put that restore power to first.
So that's in your mind when you're out
of course,
camp.
Of course.
Ready, set, go.
Kelly Enright, CEO of Vermont Electric Co-op, leans against a wooden fence and watches the competition with a smile. She points to her team, calls them her boys, and says the pride evident on her face isn't just because they're doing so well.
I'm proud of them every day. I'm glad that they're here, but it's, you know, this is like the best thing that can happen for them to come here and compete. So yes, I'm proud of them. They're good people.
The Vermont Electric Co-op is spread pretty thin. They only have four crews, and two of them are on their way to Louisiana to help restore power after Hurricane Katrina. But the team that's competing at the rodeo has a bit of an advantage. Just a year ago, they were climbing dozens of poles a day in Lakeland, Florida.
They helped out in Hurricane Ivan last year, and we do try to, if there's an opportunity, share people getting to go.
It's interesting you call it getting to go instead of getting to stay.
Because, you know, if you work in the utility business as much as you are passionate about it every single day, there is nothing like going out and responding to something that is, I don't want to say devastating, but, you know, an outage. We just feel really bad for what's gone on and just can't sit still and let it be taken care of by somebody else.
By the end of the day, Enright's crew has given her even more reason to be proud. Buoyed by their blazing time in the speed climb, they've come in first place for Vermont Electric Co-op's first championship. But Pat Hyland, director of the Northeast Public Power Association, says the rodeo isn't about who wins or loses. It's about recognizing line workers for the job they do.
You see the recognition often after a disaster when teams of utility guys go in and have to rebuild the system. You see it now in down south where they're having to rebuild a lot of systems. But those are the unusual circumstances when they're heroes, and they are heroes. Day by day, these guys go out and work, and no one kind of notices them. They're kind of invisible. So it's really neat to give them a chance to kind of be the stars of the show today, and that's what they are.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Burlington, Vermont.
Head on the back. Coming down on the back. Coming back up for a few. On the line. Coming down with the goodies.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road. Searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire. I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks this week to Robin Copley at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out photos of the Lineman's Rodeo or the WNBA Finals, browse Only a Game show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from lineman and rodeo organizer Bob Risley, who was asked why the term lineman was used to describe female line workers.
If I introduced you to any of the girls that are linemen, and I called them a line worker for politically correctness, they would break my nose.
I didn't say line worker, did I? If I did, I meant lineman, really. I meant lineman. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
And I need you more than want you. And I want you for all time.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.